Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Tech and E-commerce podcast. I am your host, Andrei Palamario, and I am the APEC Director for Elkett Global Executive Search. Our mission is to connect the tech in supply chain and e-commerce ecosystem in Asia and globally by bringing forward some of the most interesting stories about success and failure from leaders in the industry.
It is my pleasure to have with us today Andrew Hogginson. Andrew joined Infosys Consulting in 2020 and heads the consumer goods, retail and logistics practice globally. He's a lifelong consultant with over 30 years of experience driving large transformation programs and high-value consulting work. Andrew has a great track record in turnaround and monetization of practices, holding senior leadership roles previously in EY, Accenture, and Manugistics. He's a regular speaker at University of Stanford, Berkeley, and University of Washington. He's often featured in publications like the Wall Street Journal and various other industry reports. Now, our conversation has been very interesting, ranging from everything connected to trends in supply chain, trends at the global level in transportation and logistics, and also culture, teams, and how Andrew does recruitment. Please enjoy. Hi, Andrew. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Hey, Andre. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners.
Well, it's always great to have somebody with your lengthy experience in consulting in the market.
You're being nice.
it's a great learn more. So let's just start with setting the scene and giving our listeners a bit more understanding of yourself and the main milestones of the career.
Absolutely. So yeah, I started out of graduate school, didn't really know, to be honest, what I wanted to do. And I met with some representatives from Anderson Consulting and told me, well, you don't have to make a decision. You can try a little bit of everything in consulting. So that was the origin of my consulting career. So I spent, I would say roughly, well, the first 10 years of my career with Accenture or Anderson Consulting at the time in their supply chain strategy group, focusing across industries. You know, a lot of that initially was in the transportation distribution space, but then planning out into supply chain planning and some other areas. And then I left with a group of other folks from Anderson and went to become a new leadership team for what at the time was Manugistics, now part of Blue Yonder. And for my 5 years there, I split my time fairly equally between being the head of product development and then secondly, the head of their global services organization. Again, a good lens of kind of supply chain across a variety of different industries, as well as geography, spending some time down in Brazil, some time in Southeast Asia, as well as China and other parts of Asia and Europe. Through the course of that, and let's just say that was the first 14 years, I realized that most of my passion lie within the consumer-facing industries. So I decided to rejoin Accenture, and I rejoined in the retail and consumer practice. So focused solely on that industry, but really broadening out beyond supply chain, doing things like helping some of my clients opening new markets. So Starbucks, for example, we helped them open their first company-owned stores in China. I helped Costco open their operations in Spain, et cetera, right? So lots of interesting things kind of broadening out in the consumer retail. Then I left Accenture and joined EY, where I led the consumer goods and retail practice for the West Coast of the US and was there about 5 years. And then just recently joined Infosys almost seven months to the day. And at Infosys, I have global responsibility for our consumer goods, retail, and logistics practice.
It sounds like a lot of lessons, a lot of war stories, and so on. We'll touch upon a few of them for sure. But as we were talking about the experience you had, I would want to look in the future a bit. Because you've seen and you have been in so many markets, so many geographies, and also quite a few industries, right? You mentioned consumer focus, but yeah, it's retail, consumer goods, logistics, high tech, and so on. Talking about trends, right? And then supply chain oriented trends. What do you see short term, long term? Of course, we are dealing with lots of disruptions, but what's your perspective on it?
Absolutely. Well, you just hit on a key word, right? Disruptions. So when we look at what COVID has done, right? And everybody, right, has had to come to terms with the impact that COVID has had on all aspects, whether it's supply of product, right? So manufacturers have had to reduce supply and available capacity because of lack of labor or lack of efficiency in their plants, inability to put people in the plants. all the way through to the consumer who's not able to enter the stores, right? So we've seen a significant impact from an event like COVID. Now, the other thing we've learned is COVID's not an isolated event. This isn't the only one we've seen in history, and nor will it be the only one we'll see in the future. Just take the freeze in Texas and what that did to the capacity of plastics available for packaging materials, shipping materials, as well as the actual manufacture of materials in the consumer goods industry. So one of the things that companies have really learned, and one of the trends we see, is a move towards a high degree of resilience in supply chains. So putting in an ability to say when the next event happens and it causes a disruption, such as a shift in consumer, a shift in supply, a shift in whatever, our ability to respond more quickly and more effectively has got to be there. So this resilience concept at a macro level is a big trend we're seeing. And now you're seeing that build down into distribution centers and transportation. You're seeing it build into the planning. So in those areas, you're going to see things like in distribution and transportation, higher degree of automation, right? Where can we build in robotics? You know, something that Amazon obviously started a long time ago with the Kiva acquisition. So you see that. And in the planning space, you're seeing a lot more intelligence, right? Application of AI and ML that allows them to be more predictive and respond more quickly with intelligent decision-making to events that occur. So that's just a couple that I see, but really I would say all under this umbrella of resilience and not getting caught, you know, shorthanded in the next event that's going to happen.
Mm. And you mentioned, I mean, I want to double tap on the resilience part because everybody talks about it. A lot of people understand different things about it. You did mention what's important from everything connected to technology to the process. But let's say a client comes to you and they need help, right? As a doctor, you need to figure out, okay, how best to put a diagnosis and then a treatment. How do you usually do it? I know it depends on case to case, right? You can't overgeneralize too much, but I assume there are some principles that you are using when somebody says, hey, we need to build more resilience in our supply chain.
Absolutely. So what we typically will do is we'll look at their supply chain end to end, and we'll start to identify, and there's an easy way to go in and identify where some of the weak points are, right? When you look at congestion in the supply chain, when you look at throughput or capacity, is that issue sitting inside the distribution centers, for example? One of the things we saw this last holiday was that, you know, there were a lot of late shipments, and we double clicked on that. We found that it wasn't necessarily that the carriers were slow getting them to the end consumer. It was more a matter of were those shipments ready at the shipping dock in time to be picked up. So we you can then dive into that and say, okay, well, what happened? Well, we had labor shortages. We had inability to plan the volumes because so much shifted to e-commerce that much, much more quickly than we anticipated. So there's a way to really start to isolate what the issues are and where they're happening. And once you've done that, then you can start to say, okay, let's get into that area and understand what are our alternatives, right? What are our contingencies? And that's where I was talking earlier, for example, in the warehouse, can we apply automation? Can we automate using robotics in the sort capacity? Can we automate pick capacity? And what that'll do is that allows us to dial up and dial down our efficiencies and our flow through based on what's going on. The planning is the other area. We oftentimes find that when these types of events happen, and when we talk about resilience, it's a matter, not only a matter of being able to respond to an event that happened, but it's also identifying that event is happening and what the ramifications are. And that usually comes back to the planning. So we dive in there and we start to understand, well, when did you first become aware of this shift in volume in your demand? When did you first become aware of a shortage in your supply coming in from your offshore supplier? And that really identifies opportunities to enhance, whether it's the volume of data they're getting and the real-time nature of that data, whether it's how that data is being processed, right? Whether they're putting the right types of intelligence in that data so that they get earlier awareness of what's going on. And then lastly, can you build that intelligence in that says, when you see this, right, shortage in supply, here's the things that you need to do. And automating the collection of that data, the generation of ideas, the generation of contingency or what if, and getting that into people's hands. So that's typically the approach we'll take is find an issue, dive in, understand where it is, and then come up with contingencies and alternatives for addressing that. And that's kind of how we generally would approach that.
Mm. And I wanted to ask, because we were talking about trends, right? Do you see any trends connected to client behavior and client different thinking patterns? I know people like to joke around who was driving the innovation in the company. Was it the CEO, the CIO, or was it COVID? And I think the answer was obvious at the time. But I'm wondering, do you see some behavior patterns that are emerging or changing with these disruptions that are happening?
Yeah, I would say I would call out a couple of things, probably three. One is I would say companies are becoming aware that they cannot be reliant on external support as much as they have been in the past. And what that means is they're looking internally and saying, how do we enhance our internal talent? How do we develop it? How do we start to insource and develop more of a capability in-house? Now, that's not to say consulting is going to reduce. It's more a matter of how do they beef up and strengthen up their side of the equation when it comes to looking at these programs and projects and responding. So one is going to be a real inward look at talent development and really stepping up the role of their teams on these programs and transformations. I think the second thing we've seen a lot, and we've been seeing this for a little bit, but I think it's accelerating even more now, is taking what were previously longer projects and breaking them down into smaller bite size, right? It's saying we need to move more agile, more sprint focused, more proof of concept pilots, but really it's about identifying how to deliver microservices and capabilities in shorter bursts, shorter packages. And that's coming throughout, right? So even in the change management function, we have what we call micro change management, which is managing change on a smaller scale and delivering value faster in smaller bites. I think companies have been bitten too many times by setting a 1 or 2 or 3 year horizon for a program and realizing that too much has changed in that time window and that the relevance went away. So that would be a second one I would see. And then the third one that I think is really coming to the front is the tightening of the relationship between business and IT. And I would almost say cross transfer of knowledge. I'm seeing business resources that historically would have never set foot in the concept of IT are becoming more more and more intelligent about the IT side of things, right? So when you take RPA or robotics process automation as an example, I'm seeing business resources embrace that concept and develop competency within the business. On the flip side, I see the IT organization really getting a deeper understanding of the business and the operations of the business and taking more of a seat at the table and really driving some of the business strategy, business decisions. And that's manifesting in the form of some new roles. For example, one of the things we're seeing a lot is a CIO role now becoming a CDIO, Chief Digital and Information Officer. Supply chain we're seeing become much more of a blend of technology and business. And with some of these new enhanced technologies, we're seeing people in the CFO's office step out of a traditional back office role to more of a forward-looking, what if, contingency planning type of role. So we're really seeing a shift in the roles within those companies and the tightening of the IT business relationships.
That's interesting. And I wanted to take the conversation back to Infosys and consulting in general. Because, you know, people always have questions. They always will need support, help, and the better help, the better their results. I was wondering, because you've seen quite a few companies, you've worked for quite a few companies in the space of consulting. How would you say Infosys is different, or what would you say Infosys is focusing more rather than the others competitors on the market? And I'm just trying to picture, if I would have a company or I would be the CEO, how would I choose one over the other, or why would I do it?
Certainly. And actually, that's a good follow-on question or segue from what we were just talking about, because as I was evaluating in my career, right, where I was going, the reason I chose Infosys is really the answer to your question. And I'll peg a few things here. One is Infosys was born out of a culture of augmenting or plugging into a client team and supporting that client team. Many of the other firms were born out of a culture of we do the program for you, right? So it's a matter of degree of, hey, if there's 100 seats in this project team, you know, are some of these other consulting firms coming at it with the point of view of, well, we really need to fill 90 of those because we bring all the competency and the expertise, et cetera, and we'll look to plug the client in on, you know, 10 of those seats. I think with the increase in knowledge and talent and skills and capability of the client teams, they're really looking for a partner that comes in as a partner, as a collaborator, filling some gaps in where their team is, but really looking to find a way to work with the client and extract all the value out of that client team, not run over them or do it to them. And that's something Infosys is really, it's always been in our DNA from the very beginning. That's something I find when we go to our clients, we always start from a mindset of how do we bring the best athletes from both of our organizations to bear and how do we work together to solve this problem? So that I would say is number one. Number two, most everything we do these days is around or supported by a technology. And again, when you think of the roots of Infosys, they were born out of the idea of successfully deploying technology. Now, what we've successfully done is add on to that all of the management consulting, the thought leadership, what we call the tip of the spear, to really enhance, we can bring the right ideas, but guess what? We also know how to implement it, and we know how to implement it in those bite sizes that I was just talking about previously. So a lot of what Infosys has is the ability to deliver capabilities and what we call microservices. I referenced our micro change management. So we don't come at it with an attitude of, hey, we need the client to sign up for a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year project. We come at it with an attitude of, hey, let's partner, let's figure out a way. And maybe we're going to do a 3 month engagement together. Maybe we're going to figure out how to drive a quick capability into the business and then see where that goes. And then if that leads to another one, fantastic. So I think that those are two or three key differences I would call out from our competition.
That's great, Andre. And I know it's the 7 months, so I wanted to ask more about some examples. I know client names cannot be shared, but it's always interesting to see what are the projects that excite you the most, and even looking ahead, right? Of course, if you can share some excellent processes and results that have happened by Infosys coming in and offering support to a client, that would be great. But I'm just wondering, is there or are there some interesting projects in the pipeline that excite you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll probably just, for time's sake, just pick a couple here. So there's one, and again, I do need to be careful with names, but I will say it's a large apparel manufacturer and retailer. So they sit on both sides of that fence. They're a wholesale company, but they also have retail. And one of the most exciting projects we're doing is really engaging in this process of expanding their network to create a marketplace with their partners. So this is, and this isn't isolated this one client, but what we're doing right now is looking at a technology and a process whereby we can create shared data around on-hand inventories on a real-time basis at the retail locations, at the corporate wholesale location, et cetera. And then we share demand signals and demand data, all with the idea that if a consumer goes into a retail store that carries this company's products, regardless of whether it's one of their stores or one of their customer stores, and the consumer wants a certain item, if that retailer doesn't have it on hand or in stock, they have the ability not only to look within their own inventory, but upstream into the corporate inventory and also in transit inventories and identify where is that item that we can find it and get it to this customer, obviously looking at the end goal of being overnight, next day, et cetera. So this takes that endless aisle concept that we've been talking about for a while to the next level, right? Because now the endless aisle no longer is just an endless aisle within my own four walls or my distribution centers, but it extends to my partners, my suppliers, et cetera. I think that's an exciting one because, and you know, that's one example. I'm starting to see examples like that pop up, not just in apparel. We're having conversations about one in the food industry, right? Where we're talking about creating a marketplace for food manufacturers, restaurants, distributors, even home chefs, personal chefs, whereby all of these different entities could collaborate within this marketplace and identify how to deliver the best experience. So capturing personalization. This particular restaurant, the chef likes organic foods, personal preferences about, you know, regional cuisines, different things that could be shared, and then creating a marketplace whereby people can transact and share that data. So this expansion of the borders beyond your own four walls is something we're starting to see crop up. And like I said, there's one project in particular we're doing right now that is being piloted that I think creates kind of a trend that we're going to start seeing in a lot of other places. Beyond that, I have some other just personal favorites. you know, helping a large coffee company open their, and I think I mentioned this, right, open their first company-owned store in China was an exciting experience, because that was one where you talk about going into, you know, a country like China and establishing your foreign investment corporate entities, establishing a network and a brand, and figuring out how do we establish that brand there and go and grow with it. So I think new market entries, market expansion is always exciting. And then maybe the last one I'll mention is the one we're doing, that Infosys is doing right now for one of our large, it's a large food manufacturer, a global entity. And they deal with a lot of spoilage, right? So product that gets to a grocery store, hits its expiration date, it's wasted now, we got to get rid of it. And so back to what we were talking about earlier, building intelligence in the supply chain, we're working with them on two things right now. One is driving intelligence and causal-based planning to allow them to first improve the quality of the forecast, but then secondly, tie that in with the drivers and the delivery people, with the store managers, so that we can create a complete network of what product really is moving, what product do we have available, and optimize that movement of goods to decrease significantly their loss of inventory and their scrap. You know, again, I probably have to be careful with percentages, but let's just say it's a very healthy sum of mm-hmm. money and a very significant percentage in reduction of waste, inventory turns, et cetera. Those kinds of projects are the ones that I think are really interesting because, again, you know, whether it's the marketplace and the sharing of data, or whether it's applying ML, you know, machine learning and AI into a planning process and applying that over the top of causal factors, that's really taking advantage of some of the new technologies, the new capabilities that we have to really improve business and ultimately with the guide towards improving the customer experience.
Mm. Andrew, I wanted to ask, because of course, when you step in a relation of consulting, the client looks at you at many times as the entity with all the answers with a lot of the answers. And when you speak of such a large and such large projects that requires such an expertise around different IT elements from machine learning, AI, and so on, I assume that you also need a partner network that helps you implement all of these interesting technologies that can step out of the first tier, second tier of partners of the client and so on. How does that partner network for you guys work, or how do you see that?
Yeah, and I assume when you're talking about partner network, you're referencing different software providers.
Yeah.
So the way that works, I would say we have very developed relationships, obviously, with some of the bigger players out there, right? Whether that's the SAPs, the Oracles, and then on the cloud-based services, Azure, AWS, et cetera. So for those relationships, a lot of times we're all the way down into doing co-innovation, co-development, right? Where we'll actually develop extensions, enhancements on top of their platform that we see as being industry specific. So there's that depth of relationship out there with a lot of different providers. There's probably a next level below that where we have, you know, joint go-to-market, we have certified and trained resources. And similarly, we've developed teaming models of, hey, again, all of our interest is to serve the client in the best possible way. And so in that capacity, we'll say, hey, Company X, let's just pick Blue Yonder, right? Blue Yonder, you're much more qualified to fill these parts of the program, right? You bring deeper skills than us in those areas. And here's where we play, and here's where the client plays, and the three of us together, here's how we can make sure that we get the best team assembled to go deliver that to the client. And then, so that's kind of that mid-tier of, yes, we have partnerships and we work together, but it's not to the depth of where we're actually investing in co-development of solutions, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then probably the third level I'd say is emerging technologies. You know, I referenced the robotics in the warehouse. That's one where it's in its nascent stage, I would say. And, you know, there obviously are companies out there that do this and there's companies adopting it. But when you look at how big is the adoption of robotics in distribution centers right now, it's very small, right? Mm-hmm. Other than Amazon and what they've done, you don't see a ton of it. And so what we're doing there is we've got one company in particular I'm working with, where we're really getting to know each other and we're identifying some initial projects that we can go do together. In fact, we just identified one for a company in Finland that's building a brand new distribution center, and we're engaging with them to figure out how do we plug robotics in there, right? And it's going to be specifically in the goods to person movement inside the warehouse, as well as picking and sortation. So relationships like that, you know, where they're at the early stages, everybody's kind of learning, right? It's whether it's the client and, hey, this is a new technology and we've not applied robotics before, or it's us and it's our first project or two with this company and we're trying to figure out, you know, how do we work together and how exactly is the best way to deploy your solution, and, you know, for them to figure out how they fit into that puzzle. So those early stages are the fun ones, in my opinion. The others are great and they're exciting and they're what drives a lot of value in the market. But those early stage ones are exciting because you're learning and you're doing something that's really cutting edge out in the market.
Mm-hmm. No, I was curious because we also work with quite a few software service providers in the supply chain world, and we understand what their pains are and their partnerships. And it was interesting to hear your perspective on it. And it sounds like people are coming together, and entities and organizations coming together closer and closer to actually solve the bigger issues of the.
Yeah, and I think that's the important point, right? The important point is how do we work together? And I think if I'm a client, right, if I were, to your earlier point, if I were the CEO of a company and I were looking to transform some part of the supply chain and that involved a technology provider, software provider, and a consulting firm, what I would be looking for is two companies that get along, that know how to work together, that aren't going to point the finger at each other, that aren't going to try and fight each other for revenue or seats. Mm-hmm. That's really important because, you know, it's hard enough. These projects are hard enough when you're all working hand in hand towards the same objective. But if you have to deal with, you know, differences of perspective of who should lead what or how things should be approached, and you get infighting and things like that, that can be problematic just by itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. Andrew, I wanted to ask you about chips and computer chips and what's happening on the market with the crunch on that side, because I'm quite curious. I assume that I know you have more insights than I do and just read the news, but it's interesting to see how crunch in that sector has impacted so many industries, from all of them, consumer included. I'm just wondering, what's your take on it? What's happening? What will happen? What should happen? How do you see the chipset crunch?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because that's this plastics thing I referenced earlier, right? The freeze in Texas impacted mm-hmm. that as well. And I think, you know, what is happening with the fact that computer chips are so prevalent in so many different products, devices, you know, whether it's cars, obviously phones, laptops, you know, video devices, et cetera, and then consumer products as well. I think everybody's become so reliant on them and depend on them that once some of these events happen, like this shortage of raw materials that are used to manufacture the chips, it opens up people's eyes to, all right, how do I now decrease my dependency? How do I improve my supply capacity, my supplier planning capacity, my relationships? How do I do better planning, right? Because one of the interesting thing back in this plastics shortage, which again is, you know, kind of an example of the shortage of chips, is the industry didn't really have good visibility before the freeze happened. The industry didn't have good visibility to what the demand was. So they kind of turned capacity down, which created an artificially tight supply. And then when the freeze happened, it blew the floor out and they were way out, right? It was like, they just didn't have anything in terms of supply. So I think the better that companies are able to plan what the demand looks like on a longer term horizon, and then work collaboratively between the companies that are consuming the chips as well as the manufacturers, as well as look for alternative supply forms, whether it's alternative raw materials that could be used to manufacture chips, et cetera. I think that's ultimately where this needs to go. So I would say it's a combination of enhanced planning so that we don't artificially, you know, choke down supply, as well as improved supply planning and supplier management and sourcing programs. Let's just call it sourcing, right? So that we find alternative sources of supply when one dries up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's all about the planning, like you said, but you really need to put the correct data and the correct process in order to have the right output so you make the right decision. It's not an easy thing to pull off, and that's where partnerships and help comes in. But Andrew, wanted to change a bit the direction of the discussion and talk more on teams and leadership, because this is very connected to our bread and butter, which is executive search and recruitment. And I wanted to ask you about a good company culture and how you define that. You've seen so many, you've worked in so many, and you've worked with so many different type of organizations with different type of cultures. What is a good company culture for you? And then maybe you can connect it to what you see now in Infosys.
Sure. Yeah, I guess if I think about it right, there's three things that come to mind right away. Probably the first thing I would call out from a company culture or positive culture perspective is diversity, right? And when I say diversity, obviously there's an element of that that's about diversity of gender, diversity of race, et cetera, to make sure that the culture represents the customers we serve, the, you know, geographies we live in, et cetera. But going beyond that, I think also diversity of thought, right? A positive or a good culture is one that embraces diversity of thought and doesn't say, hey, there's one way to think about things and it's the culture and it's the company's way. And if you don't conform to that, then you don't fit in, right? That can be very stifling, very, you know, it takes the oxygen out of the room for people. So diversity would be one of the first things I would talk about. The second thing I would probably look for is a very flat hierarchy. So clearly we've got levels within any organization we operate in. And we've all heard the term servant leader and inverted pyramid, et cetera. But those are great terms. I think realistically, when you get into a company, you find out very quickly how flat is that hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm a brand new consultant, can I pick up the phone and call a partner and ask them for advice? Can I set up weekly calls with them just to get some coaching and you know, get some support? You know, so that ability to maneuver and work through the different tiers of a company and operate as a team. And, you know, if we get together to go solve a problem, right, is there, again, a flat, everybody's in the team, everybody's got a say, everybody's got a point of view. I think that's the second thing I always look for in a positive culture. And probably the third, and it's a heavily used word, but I think testing if it really exists or not is important, is collaborative, right? When I get into a company, do I find I'm part of a team that really does support each other and collaborate and help each other out? Or do I feel like I'm kind of left to my own to figure it out, right? And I have in my career experienced that even within a single company, right? You get into different parts of that company, different divisions or business units. I find varying levels of collaboration. And as I look back on the, gosh, I guess it's almost 32 years now that I've been doing this, my fondest memories are of those tightly coupled teams that, you know, obviously we all got along professionally and socially, but we all supported each other, right? And you could be in the middle of a firefight, but if somebody called up and said, hey, I really need help, I'm trying to figure this piece out, or I need a connection to this client to talk about X, that person was right there to help you. They didn't stop and think, well, what's in it for me? You know, hey, are you gonna share the revenue with me? No, no, it was about supporting each other and then sharing ideas and information. That, it just makes the workday better, right? And, you know, kind of the last part of it that I'll share is, especially in the consulting industry, the amount of value I personally can bring to a client is not limited to what I know, but it's really a matter of not only what I know, but the network of people that I have and that I can tap into to bring the best thought leadership, the best ideas, the best experience to that client. And so really building that network, having that collaborative environment where I know I can pick up the phone and call someone and they'll support me and help this client. That to me is what I'd call out as the third element of a really strong positive culture.
And Andrew, has it happened that a client calls you in and says, hey, Andrew, we need help with this problem. This is the process that doesn't work. These are the KPIs that we need to hit and we are not hitting them. And then you go in and you realize it's not necessarily a process problem, but a human behavior problem.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Adherence. I mean, you talk about process, technology, and people, right? We talk about those all the time. And oftentimes the people is the third aspect that's not thought about, or it's the first one to get cut out of the budget to really dig in and understand that. And I have found time and again that, like you're saying, it's not necessarily a bad process, but it's rather a bad adoption of the process, adherence. And, you know, one of the things when we look at, we oftentimes are asked to come into a company and assess their processes, right? And we'll assess them against a benchmark and a set of best practices. And in doing that, we have what we call a maturity model, right? And the maturity models range from 1 to 5, right? Now, 1 being the process is applied inconsistently. It's very manual. The data is inconsistent and poor at times. There's very little measurement and metric back. When you look at a 5, I think one of the biggest factors that we see in what, you know, beyond automation and technology is that process consistently followed? Is it well understood? And is it consistently followed not only by each individual, but across different geographies and business units? So that consistency of the people and how they operate and how well they understand the process is absolutely one of the key elements of maturity of a process.
And now we spoke about the people. Wanted to ask you about how you interview, Andrew, and what's important for you in the process, right? Because I assume you have to be involved quite a bit, and you have been involved in the past in interviewing and recruiting people for your own direct team, for other teams. What's your thinking? What are your principles when interviewing?
Yeah, so there's, you know, so my first test is just interpersonal skills, right? In my business, interpersonal skills are critical. So I look for the basics, right? Good eye contact, ease of conversation, listening, you know, listening as much as talking, engaging. So, you know, call it gravitas, call it poise, whatever phrase you want to use, but it's really that interpersonal element of, is this an engaging person? And can I see them, bringing them out to a client site, to a program, introducing them to executives, et cetera. So that'd be one element. Then in the consulting world, we really break the interview down into two real halves. One half is the domain experience or the content, what you know, right? If I'm interviewing you for a role in our ERP team, what's your depth in SAP? Do you really understand the solution? Are you up to speed on S4? You know, which modules, which areas of the solution do you understand? Have you done it there? You know, you've done it and implemented it, et cetera. So it's that, or if it's an industry role, right? You tell me, you know, supply and demand planning in the consumer facing industries. Let's drill in a little bit. Talk to me about what you see as the trends, right? What do you think the role of data and causal data is? And, you know, so just probing on content and knowledge, right? Do they really have the depth to play the role they're talking about? And then the other half of what we look for is what we call those consulting skills, right? So that's the soft skills. And that's everything from facilitating, you know, a workshop, leading a presentation, listening to clients and gathering requirements and understanding how to interpret what a client's saying into a business requirement. Problem solving skills, right? Clearly the ability to break a problem down and solve it. And then the last piece of that would really be, you know, conflict management. In consulting, projects are never easy, right? Yeah. You always have those projects where you hit a rough spot and it's like, how do you handle that? How do you handle it when you get into the fire and have to deal with that? So those are the kinds of things I'll look for. And then I guess the last layer I would say I look for is really, what's this person's objective? What are they trying to do? So one of the first questions I always start with is, you know, when we're doing introductions is maybe spend a little bit of time telling me what you've been doing, but more importantly, tell me what the next chapter in your career looks like. What's your objective? What do you want to do? Because I want to hear that gut answer that says, this is what I want to do, and understand how does that align with the role I'm hiring for?
That's an excellent breakdown, Andrew. I appreciate your sharing. And I like how you said the conflict management part, because each time you call for somebody to come in and help, there's definitely a change needed. And with change, conflict is inevitable. Now, how high or low it goes, it depends, but yeah. Yeah, so Andrew, as the last question of our discussion, because I know you have things to do, people to help, what would be the best piece of advice for a successful career that you've gathered so far? I mean, you have a lot of years of doing your work, and I wanted to ask about this piece of advice.
Absolutely. And I'll give you two pieces, actually, because okay. I get asked this question a lot. And for me, the two pieces I always advise people on are, number one, you need to be your number one advocate for your career. We all have mentors. We all have people that are, you know, supporting us, so et cetera. But at the end of the day, you are the most important person when it comes to advocating for yourself. Now, whether that's advocating for what you want to do from a work-life balance perspective, whether that's advocating for the next role you want to have, whatever it is, right? Being vocal about that, looking for those opportunities, positioning yourself for those opportunities, and advocating. Again, I always tell people, don't be shy. Don't assume someone else has it covered for you. Don't assume it'll be taken care of because, you know, the corporate presentation says that we have this natural process of handling these. You know, at the end of the day, if you don't advocate for yourself, you know, shame on you for not, you know, if the results don't turn out the way you want. And then number two, I would say build, maintain, and value a network of people, right? If I go back, and I'm not saying just get a bunch of followers on LinkedIn. It's not about how many people do I have in my LinkedIn network. It's about how many people could you really reach out to and they would reply, right? And the importance of that, it's manyfold, right? I mean, there have been a number of times where a friend of mine that was part of my network, maybe we worked together, ended up at a company. In fact, I had a recent example. Someone ended up at Home Depot, and they were working in a certain area of the business that happened to relate very closely to a project we were doing at Nordstrom. And I said to this friend of mine at Nordstrom, I said, hey, I've got a friend at Home Depot who's 6 months ahead of you. Let's connect the two of you to talk about kind of what their experience has been. And, you know, I was able to pick up the phone, call the guy at Home Depot, get him on the phone with Nordstrom. And that was of great benefit to Nordstrom. And that's just one example, right? But being able to leverage a network, and that means both you're giving into that network, right? So you're helping people when they reach out to you and say, hey, I need some advice. Hey, I need a new job. Hey, I need X, Y, Z. But then there's times when you take out of that bank as well, right? And you say, hey, I need a piece of advice, or I'd love to talk to you about what you guys are doing. So that network, to me, has been one of the most valuable things in my career. And again, it goes back to that point I raised earlier about the value I can bring to my clients is not just me, but it's me plus my network.
Mm. Thank you for that, Andrew. I do appreciate that. Both of them, excellent points. And on this note, I want to thank you for the podcast and for the discussion. It was, I learned a lot. I hope that our listeners will do the same. And I wish you the best day. I'm sure you will have a lot of good stories and projects coming with your Infosys story.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Andre. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For all the show notes and information discussed in the episode, please follow elcatglobal.com/podcast. Also, if you found this interesting, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or one of the podcast platforms. We are looking forward to your feedback.